body moves. It also, I don't know, it makes me think about your connection to music and movement, which you talked about a little bit earlier. What are some, like, what are some of, like, the top things recently, or maybe, like, more like legacy, like stuff that you, that really stuck with you when you were younger or when you were a kid that has informed that kind of exploration and your style?
Well, you know, as a kid, I did ballet for a little bit, and then I played tennis for a very long time. So I've always been interested in athletics and dance and movement. My dad is a track and field coach and track and field athlete. So I think, yeah, throughout my life, I've just been interested in, like, physiology and human anatomy and the way that we're able to, like, push our bodies to the limits and also, like, express all these different concepts through movement. What comes to mind too is I'm very influenced by different choreographers. Specifically, I mean, what comes to mind first is Pina Bausch, who was a German choreographer, and you may recognize her work in the documentary Pina, which is like a retrospective of her different choreographed works. I'm also very influenced by Bob Fosse, and I love his films, but the way that he also photographs and choreographs the human body is, it's what I aim to do through illustration.
That's so cool. Oh man. It's so exciting because I feel like, are you familiar with JoJo's Bizarre Adventure?
You know, I haven't watched it, but I am familiar with it. Yes. I mean, that's another example of someone who's like, I don't remember the creator of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, or like the character designer. Yeah. But I know for sure there's a lot of like fashion references in that show. And yeah, the way that the bodies are drawn too, they always feel like they all have kind of like ballet dancer anatomy, which is funny.
Yeah, yeah. I just love the, I don't know, the sentiment about like trying to capture movement and all of the kind of like funky ways that the body works in a still piece of art while also making it still really dynamic is very, very interesting. One of the works that I saw last year, and I think I saw this year as well, maybe, at your table was a zine about the albums that you've been listening to and the musicians who have been inspiring your art recently. Anybody in particular right now?
I had two zines that were called What Have You Been Listening To? And I made one this year that kind of just reflects on like different artists that I've been listening to on different streaming services. But let me think. Out of everyone that I've featured, I'm listening a lot to Erica DeCassier, who is, I believe, Swedish. I forget. She's Scandinavian. But she's tapping into this wave of like trip hop and more ethereal pop kinds of sensibilities. Erica DeCassier, as well as, oh, I've been re-listening to Anjali, who has a couple albums, a bit more obscure, but she blends, again, like trip-hop and ethereal pop with kind of like 60s, almost like spy music. There's like some bossa nova elements to it, but it's really fun and funky, and yeah, it just makes me want to groove.
Yeah, I feel like when I first saw those zines, and like it struck something within me, and I was like, this is also a fanzine. And maybe why have I not also considered doing something like this before? Because, you know, a big part of also doing a radio station is like needing to listen to a lot of music. Mm-hmm. But inevitably, like, your time runs out on the show and you can't talk at length about like certain albums or musicians and stuff like that. I don't know. I just really, really loved it.
Oh, thank you. I have to mention also that I just self-published a book called Divas of Disco, so I have to shout out all my disco divas, of course. But yeah, it's fun to also do all this research about different musicians, because you start to connect the past to the present, and you start to look into like who influenced them, and it's such a fun rabbit hole of finding artists who are in conversation with you, with each other.
Oh yeah, definitely. Like you're really able to witness, like for example, like with disco, right? You're really able to witness like how that genre was interpreted by different artists and how like it changed throughout the era, mm-hmm. and that type of thing. Yeah, that's such a good point. Can you talk a little bit more about your personal relationship to zine making? Like what kind of got you into that? Yeah, let's start there.
Mm-hmm. I started making zines when I was studying illustration in my undergrad studies at Cal State Long Beach. And I had a teacher who did like murals and zines and comics and stuff. And he had us make a little, like a mini zine made of one 11 by 17 paper. And it just like broadened my horizons for what I wanted to make. I think I've always been drawn towards narrative comics and felt intimidated by making, you know, larger graphic novels or trying to make something coherent. But zines were a great way for me to just exercise these different skills and to make quick self-published mini magazines about whatever I wanted. And I could always come back to it and turn it into a larger project. So I tabled at my first zine fest in Long Beach, where I'm from. And that was in 2016, I think. And I tabled with a couple friends that were also in the illustration department. And we each basically had our one assignment from that class. And then we printed out some stickers and postcards and stuff, but it was super fun and it really inspired me to keep making zines.
Yeah, I often hear from folks who make zines, like they love the the exploratory and the experimental element, yeah, of doing that, because yeah, like it's not as maybe restrictive as making a traditional comic book or graphic novel, or even like a painting, but it's still, the purpose of it is still to tell a story. And so the process of making it and how to go about it oftentimes is the exciting part for a lot of people who make zines.
Yeah, and I think also what you're pointing to is like there isn't this expectation for it to be super polished or commercially viable, or it's just explorative. And I think that's what really drew me to it, was that the stakes were so low. Like I wasn't making illustrations for clients, especially at that time when I was in my undergrad and I was intimidated by the field of illustration. This was a great way for me to work through these different ideas.
Yeah, definitely. Having made zines for 10 years. What is your relationship to it now? Has it shifted? Is there something that you love about it even more now? Maybe something that you kind of hate about it? Like, what is that relationship like?
You know, I think I've started to categorize my work a little bit differently. I've now, because I have some smaller zines, but some of my like longer ones where I spend more time researching, I've just been calling them books. And that's not to, that isn't, you know, shade to zines at all. I think it's like trying to see where I'm at with making zines. And I still think that the zines that I make are extremely explorative, and they're fun little like creative challenges, as opposed to some of my longer works.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for sitting down with me today.
Yeah.
Yeah, can you share also where people can find your artwork, where they can follow your work and support it? Because personally, I really want the listener to take a look at your stuff. I'm very, very inspired by the way that you use the pen. So, yeah, talk a little bit about that.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. My name is Sophia Zarders. You can follow me on Instagram at Sophia Zarders. My website is sophiazarders.com. It's very easy to find me. I have a very unique name. I also teach illustration, drawing, and media studies at Emily Carr University of Art and Design, and Lincare College. You can find me online or at local zine fests and art book fairs.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Sophia.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
This is Bird Note. In higher animals, the brain is like a Lamborghini. Amazing engineering, but expensive to run. In a human, the brain uses about 10 times more energy than any other organ. A bird's system is exquisitely attuned to this expense. And among several carefully studied species like the black-capped chickadee, a very smart adaptation has evolved. You can usually hear the black-capped chickadees call throughout fall and winter, but they aren't singing much. They don't need to. So in their brains, the centers that control how they learn and give voice to songs shrink. But as spring nears and the birds resume singing in earnest, these control centers in the brain rejuvenate. This same seasonal fluctuation appears true of the chickadee's hearing ability. Experiments have shown that a bird's hearing is more acute in spring. So is their ability to interpret sounds. This may help male birds tell the difference between a neighboring male he already knows and an interloper who's infringing on his territory. And more finely attuned hearing can also help a female bird rate the songs of males she hears so she can pick out the best partner. All of which means that seasonal changes in the gray matter itself put birds' brains in a class by themselves. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Back here on Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. Leslie here, as you know. If you didn't, you're not listening to the right show. One final interview for you today here at Vancouver Art Book Fair. I'm here with Halem.
Hello, everyone. I'm Halem Ng. I am the founder of Butchie Projects and who is presenting at the Vancouver Art Book Fair this year.
I know we weren't really going to talk a lot about your artist collective, but because you did introduce yourself as one of the founders, let's first, could you introduce a little bit about your art collective, and then we'll talk a little bit more about your individual work.
Sure. So the art collective is currently made up with three book artists. At one point, I went to school with them in different times. So me and my buddy Carly, she got a new last name that I cannot pronounce. It's French.
Okay.
Boisjoli. So we went to Emily Carr at the same time, and then we were the two grads at the moment that left making books. So after we graduated, we started to table at the Vancouver Art Book Fairs together, but under our independent names, starting in 2015. So it has been 10 years since we do book stuff together. And then I moved to Montreal briefly for my master between 2021 to 25, where I met Megan Stein. She's also a book artist, and then we invite her to join the group, and then we now all started to table together under the name of Bochi Project. But we do not actually make work together. We just go to fairs together. Yes.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, that definitely makes sense. Can I ask really quickly, where did the name Bochi come from?
Yes. It's a Japanese term. Come from the phrase called Hitori Bochi. It means kind of like solitary, being alone, but not necessarily in the bad way. When I picked this name, I was thinking about Bochi Project maybe can turn into a vanity press. That's someone, if they need help to make a book project, they can reach out to us, we can do consultation, we can give them advice and tell them where they can get their books print, so that they are not doing these things alone, but they can also do it alone with some help.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it made me think about, I don't know if you, do you watch anime?
I know there is an anime with the same name, because now when people search Bochi, it's the anime.
Bochi the Rock. Yeah. But okay, yeah, that makes sense. That, yeah, I guess that also just coincides, like, it also coincides with the collective as well, right? Because, like, you are making individual works, but you're not really doing it alone.
Yes, I mean, we don't really call ourselves a collective because we don't make work together. We only do the show together, but sometimes we use the term very loosely. And to be honest, we don't really bond like a collective.
Oh.
We just think that there are benefits to exhibit together under a group name rather than having like three individual names showing up in fairs.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Okay, thank you for correcting me. Let's talk a little bit about your individual practice then, because earlier I was roaming around the fair with a few of my friends, and we stopped at your table, and we were really struck by the way that you conceptualize bookmaking and art. Can you talk a little bit, maybe first, about your relationship to books in general? Like, what got you into specifically making books?
So as a kid, I really liked stationery and books, like any publication. Like if I get a new textbook, I love to smell them. So I've always enjoyed the physicality of a book object, but not to an extent that I would love to make them. And I was from Hong Kong, and then art in Hong Kong is not really a thing that get appreciated. Like you get to do art classes when you're in elementary school, but then when you get into senior high school, they don't let you make art anymore. So I actually was never picturing myself becoming an artist, not to mention to make books. But then I came to Canada as an international student, and then I went to high school, where I had this amazing art teacher. He just encouraged us to make anything. And then there was one of this project, he just gave us really old hardcover books, and he told us there's a medium called artist books, we are welcome to cut up the pages, we are welcome to doodle in it, and then he showed us example. And it was just fascinating to me because book has always been like a perfect, meticulous object to me. But the fact that I can doodle in it, I can cut it up, I can paint on it and make it a special art piece, that was a very interesting idea for me. That was the introduction to me making book as artwork. But then when I was doing my undergrad at Emily Carr, I took this class from the artist Kathy Busby, who is also exhibiting at the Vancouver Art Book Fair this year. She was teaching this printed matter class, and she introduced the idea of art text, using text as art, making art with text. And then she also showed us the possibility of making publication or printed matter that takes the forms of books or not. It can be a postcard, it can be a flyers. And I got very, very inspired by her work and the way she used text in her work. And she is basically the reason why I start doing what I'm doing. So I use a lot of text in my work now. I'm still trying to figure out what is text art, how to make art with text. But then I take more of like hand-on technical classes of how to like bind the books and learn more about the terms of bookbinding, book arts, But I would say Kathy Busby is the reason why I start doing what I'm doing.
That's amazing. And also, as an aside, also, it's kind of, I feel like maybe I didn't know enough about Hong Kong or anything like that. My parents are from Guangzhou.
Oh, okay.
So we know some of the cultural references. It's kind of wild to me to hear about how art is not as encouraged for people to partake in when you get older, because whenever I think about like really impactful East Asian like graphic design and like, what is it called? Like font and text and things like that, I always think about Hong Kong. That's kind of wild.
Oh, that's so interesting. I would think about Japan and Taiwan for design.
Yes.
But you had a good point, but design is design. There is a businessy string attached to design. You can make money off design, but you probably are not going to make stable money off art. But I'm speaking about Hong Kong maybe like 20, 25 years ago. So I moved to Canada 18 years ago as a teenager. It was just the education system was a little bit different back in the days. We had less elective. And we only study for the sake of taking the government exam, because that's what gets you into university. And then you have to go to university because then hopefully you can land a good job. So I think most Asian parents at that time in Hong Kong, they want you to have a good job, like with the government, or you can be a lawyer, you want to be a doctor, at least be a teacher. That's the saying, like, if you cannot be a lawyer or a doctor, at least you gotta be a teacher or work for the government, just because they want you to have stable income. So art was never a thing that was in their mind that they can see as like a stable income for the kids. I fought with my parents when I wanted to go to art school. Yeah.
That's very relatable. I definitely hear you when you say that. You mentioned earlier when you were talking about your relationship to how you got into bookmaking. The words that struck me were, books to me were this perfect, meticulous object. Can you expand on that a little bit? Because, yeah, so much of what we learned about at your table today was about your deep passion for books.
So going back to the childhood I spent in Hong Kong, they do encourage us to read a lot of different literature in our teenage. They have specific genre for like high school student, elementary school student, and then they always want you to write school reports. So anyway, I spent a lot of time in the library and like bookstore picking books because I have to read a lot and I have to write. And all these books are like published books. And they are perfect, meticulous objects. Like they are they have order, they have index, and they have colophon. And it's always some sort of stories or facts, like if it's nonfiction books. And I never had experience like a different, slightly different book. Like maybe the most exciting was like pop-up books. But then I could not even imagine that there is a thing called art book where you can doodle, you can draw, you can cut, you can do all kind of crazy things in it. I think that was a cultural thing as kids having to read a lot of these meticulous printed books. Yeah, and then that's my recognition of books at the time.
Yeah. Another thing that I found really interesting when you were sharing was the way that like a book that is largely made of text and content struck you. Because I feel like when I think about Vancouver Art Book Fair, I draw for fun, and so immediately what I think about are comics and illustrative zines, or something with mostly images. But your approach is a lot of text. And at your table today, you had two books that were, I think, two books that were the same in content, but they were the book itself.
Binding.
Yes, it was made totally differently. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes. first going back to the text focus, I would love to be able to draw, but unfortunately I cannot, and maybe that's why I just pick text because everybody can type. I was a photo major in my undergrad, so when I took Kathy's class, the first two books I made in her class was my photo books. There's no text in it. I wasn't comfortable writing at the time because ESL. But then I get better. I had help. So when I worked for that magazine company, I met editors and then they taught me more grammar, and then I had help editing one of my books as well. It was a short story printed on this vellum paper. That was a story I wrote, but then I had editing help. And then since then, I feel a little bit better of using text, but also because I never fully feel comfortable writing text, I start using them differently. So that's when you see my other books on the table, I use them as visual elements. So the books that you were talking about is my latest work. I was overlapping the text to make a collage, and these texts were my notes, my essay, my presentation, my grading comments, that kind of. So it was a collection of texts that I've written during my MFA, and I wrote a lot and I got better and I got more comfortable and I grade a lot, and then I realized I need to get better in order to grade the students. So I did improve a lot in writing, and I've never written so much in my life in a condensed period, and I just thought, why don't I use all these texts I write, but then not in the sense of just presenting them as what they were. And so I create this text collage. It's kind of like a blackout poetry because I overlap the text so much. You can only read some of it. And the funny thing about that is I got the comments today from different people. They're saying, so everyone read this book and they will get a different outcome. Like they will read different content from the same pages. And I thought that was just so true. You will, because you're probably attracted to a certain vocabulary, or you missed this line because you didn't want to spend too much time trying to decode it. I thought that was beautiful. And then I love hearing this kind of comments from other people. And the binding difference is something I wanted to experiment with this project. I love teaching workshops. I started teaching bookbinding workshops when I was in Concordia, and then I moved back to Vancouver, and now I start teaching bookbinding workshop at Malasapina on Granville Island. So this project, I wanted to showcase how important and what a difference the binding technique can be, even though you have the same content. So the pages of this book is exactly the same, printed the same. But because the binding method is very different, the two books read like two different objects, two different books. The order of it is different, the experience is different, one of them is signatures. So you get like a full spread that go across two pages. But then the other one is a Japanese step bind, so they're bind as single sheets, and you do not get a spread at all. And in order for you to read the inner content within the folded pages, you do have to cut open the pages. And that is kind of like a fun thing for the reader to do.
That's so cool. I love how, yeah, how deeply conceptual that is. And for something that I think maybe a lot of people don't recognize, there's such like a craftsmanship and artistry to making something that a lot of the times people don't really associate with art. So that's so cool. Yeah. I am looking at our time and I don't want to hold you any longer than you should be here. So where can people support your work and learn more about your art practice?
And I have a website, www.heilamng.com, or you can find me on Instagram, heilum.bocchi. So heilum.bocchi. And I teach bookbinding workshops at Malasapina Printmakers Society on Granville Island. We're a nonprofit artist-run center focusing in printmaking. So if you're interested, you can check out the website. We do all sort of printmaking workshops.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for sitting down with me today, Heilum.
And thank you for inviting me, Leslie.
Thank you so much again to Isha, Sophia, and Heilum for joining me on Typically Tuesdays at the Vancouver Art Book Fair last weekend. I hope you enjoyed listening to today's episode. Thank you for tuning in. I've been Leslie.
You have tuned in to Open Mic on CJSF Radio, broadcasting on 90.1 FM from Burnaby Mountain, BC.